Great. I'd like to thank Cynthia and Daniel for inviting me here, and I'm really looking forward to being part of the book project too. Now that I'm thinking about the reality of it, though, it's another little challenge. Daniel's question actually about monitoring soil carbon, I'll get into that a little later, latter part of my slides here today. So it's kind of a big topic. I thought I'd start with this sort of kind of a climate type slide, climate change slide. I'd like to start with this one for a couple of reasons. One, it's not talking about model projections, but sort of illustrates how climate change is already upon us. This is the plant hardiness zone map, which is based on the minimum winter temperatures using NOAA weather station records of the last 15 years. And on the left-hand side, you can see the 1990 map. And you can see by 2006, no matter where you live in the continental United States, you're pretty much in a different winter hardiness zone. This, to me, you know, brings up a couple of major points. One is that the pace of change that we're seeing today already, and that's projected for this century, is really unprecedented, actually, in the history of the human race. So it's not a wonder that we're having a little trouble getting our minds around coping with this. So it's a very fast pace of change, not the kind of long-term geological change where we've seen vegetation change with climate, et cetera, that we've seen in the past. So it's a lot for farmers to be adapting to. Also, this not only dictates, of course, where the home gardener, what plants, ornamentals they might buy, what crops we might be growing in different parts of the country, but minimum winter temperatures are highly linked with insect population shifts, and so the range shifts of insects and weeds is a major issue challenging farmers as we go through this. Quite a number of scientists around the Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere as well, have looked at historical records of phenological events, things like insect migrations, first bloom dates of plants, etc. This is some of our own work showing that it's really not just the weather instruments now telling us that the climate change is already upon us, but the living world is already responding. And these are just some examples that where we have historical records to document this. So when I did some of this work myself and sort of saw it firsthand, I really got even more alarmed. I've been doing work with climate change and CO2 since the late 80s, but seeing this has really struck me in terms of how urgent sort of the issue is that we get on with doing something about this, solutions. So I would say our challenge really is, you know, we're really the first generation of farmers, humans. We really can't rely on the past historical climate to tell what's going on and they're going to go on in the future and to make decisions. As I said, the pace of change, it's just not a little bit faster. It's about 100 times faster than we saw it since the last glacial ice age, for example, in terms of the pace of change projected for this century. And so for all of us, really all of society, but for this group in particular, we really have to think about new approaches to environmental monitoring to track where are new range, where are the new insects coming and going, where are, should our crops be going. And particularly the new decision tool thing is something I want to bring up a little more later, where I think a lot of the adaptations for farmers, there is, you know, a whole lot of new research needed, and we need new crop varieties, crop breeding efforts, et cetera. But a lot of the adaptations are actually already there. But the problem for farmers is it's not a cost or risk-free decision to make some kind of adaptation. So the thing of when do I make an investment to adapt and how much do I invest is a big challenge. And then, of course, as we've already heard a lot about, and I'll talk a little bit more about it, there's a lot of creative approaches to reducing greenhouse gas emissions in agriculture. So for the farming community, and it depends on where you are in the world in terms of a farmer, what it means. In some parts of the world, it can actually mean some opportunities, potential, those cold regions. I'm from the northeastern U.S., upstate New York. And for there, a longer growing season, talk to farmers about that, warmer summers, they go, wow, I can grow certain crops I couldn't grow before. And so we have to take it in, you know, at Cornell, and I'm sure at your institutions as well, we're all about helping farmers take advantage of many opportunities like that, new market opportunities. But a lot of risks, and even in those regions where there could be some kind of, there is, you know, some sectors might get some benefit, there's still a lot of risks. Actually, what we're seeing in the northeastern U.S. is more freeze damage in some warmer winter years to some of our perennial fruit crops, for example. How could this happen? Well, it can in warm December followed by a normal January, you can bring perennial crops out of their hardening, their physiological hardening, and then they're more susceptible to freeze damage. Earlier spring bloom dates can mean increased risk of frost. And then we have the issues of with warmer temperatures, of course, more heat stress. And I mentioned already the pest and weed species shifting around, creating new challenges. And then with water, in a place like in much of the Northern Hemisphere, we're seeing right now increased frequency of heavy rainfall events. And so in many parts of the Northern Hemisphere, at least, it's too much water is part of the problem and flooding. We had terrible problems with this in parts of the eastern U.S. this year with millions of dollars of damage. It's actually a picture taken recently. With the warmer winters, you know, in those regions where currently some insect pests have been constrained because of die-off during the winter, there's going to be more overwintering of those pests, more generations of insects per season in areas where there's historically been shorter growing seasons. So for cool parts of the globe, you really see these challenges with more insect pests. And I think that's one of the big things farmers are going to have to be adapting to. And this is at a time when a lot of our budgets are being cut for things like integrated pest management when we need it most. This is just some data from Don Wobbles at University of Illinois showing some projections for the increased, using climate model projections, for the increased problems with corn earworm in the Midwest. So the color coding, you can just see moving up towards Lake Michigan, more and more issues with corn earworm in for Midwest growers. And this is very common throughout a lot of cool regions with new things moving in that weren't problems before. This is some of our own work showing some modeling work looking at kudzu, the notorious invasive weed species that currently right now is in the southern U.S. And across the top panel, it's going from near term to end of century, business as usual scenario. The dark orange indicates the habitable zone by the terms of the climate at least for kudzu, this very aggressive weed. And it's kind of like for upstate New York, it's kudzu coming to get us. So we worry about things like that. Another issue with weeds is, as Lou Ziska at USDA, some of you may know him, he's done a lot of work on weeds and CO2 and climate change. And this is some of his work showing that at normal CO2, using glyphosate Roundup, got good control in this case of Canadian thistle. At future CO2, the Canadian thistle is much more resistant. So not only new weeds, more aggressive weeds, but we may need to be using more herbicides to get similar levels of control. So a farmer adaptation to this is what? Probably be using more chemicals. This is an issue and a kind of a looming conflict between environmental concerns and farmers being able to adapt and make a profit. So something we have to have on our radar screens. With the longer growing seasons and sort of those opportunities in some of the cooler parts of the world with climate change, but it's still going to mean more summer heat stress than we've seen before. And even for a place again, I refer to the northeastern U.S. where I'm most familiar with the details of the climate projections. There we're seeing we're seeing more flooding problems now, but we also have projections at the same time for more summer drought. Our rainfall is not projected to decline in the summer where I'm from, but we're going to have longer growing seasons and much warmer temperatures, so crop ET will be up. And if we don't have a concomitant increase in precipitation, our irrigation needs can be going up. Heat stress also, of course, affects livestock. Milk production, this is some modeling work we did on milk production of dairy cows showing fairly dramatic reductions in milk production in the northeastern U.S. Due to heat stress. So what do farmers need? They need from folks like us here in these societies quite a number of things, as well as information from the climate scientists. First of all, from the climate scientists, there's a lot of confusion out there among farmers between weather and climate, and in particular weather events, I think, are for climate scientists and for those of us who work with farmers an opportunity, a teaching moment, talking about particular weather events and to what extent they are or are not possibly part of a long-term climate change trend. So farmers don't want to be adapting to something that is just a normal, quote, normal climate variability. On the other hand, we don't want them waiting too long if it's a trend that's really here to stay. But then also in terms of the climate data, they really need much more than, as Chuck Rice mentioned, average temperatures are not really what is important to us, but it's things like the frequency of extreme events affecting biological thresholds. Of course, freeze damage, frost damage is a classic example of that. Also, a lot of complex interactions with the climate. For example, snow cover. We're having reduced snow cover days in parts of the Northern Hemisphere due to climate change. That has dramatic effects on soil temperatures, dramatic effects. One of my grad students has shown some pretty significant effects on nitrogen retention in soils. So those kinds of things are important. In terms of impacts, of course, we'll tend to focus on the biological and crop yields, et cetera, and the economic things, but there's also social and environmental issues as well. The timing, this is a very important thing for farmer adaptation. Is this something that's happening now, a trend that's real and happening now? Is this something that's projected for 30, 50 years down the road? So that's fairly important. And then adaptation, there's issues both on the farm, what the farmer can do, and then there's things like what can universities do to provide new information for farmers and build new tools. And then even if you know what to do, you've got the problem, you've got to have money to do it, you've got to get the information if you're the farmer, and you've got to have some tools to make those kind of decisions. And for each of these things in this list, there are levels of certainty we have to bracket each of those. So it's not just bracketing the certainty about climate risks. There's also a certainty about the impacts, et cetera. This is just running through one example of sort of looking at those information needs. So this is the flooding risk issue, increased high rainfall events. So let's go through that as an example. Impacts, everything from delayed planting having big economic impacts to reduced yields, compaction, and environmental issues I don't have listed here, erosion, for example. The timing, this is happening now, and it's the trend is real. It's statistically been documented for many parts of the globe. And so it's not something that's 30, 50 years down the road with climate projections. Adaptations, put in tile drains. What's the problem? Well, that costs something. And when do you do that? Do you do that this year, or wait and see how many years you take a hit before you do it? So this is where we really need the new tools for farmers. And then the adaptation capacity. This is an example where we actually, we know what to do in a lot of cases. But it can be costly. So farmers are going to need these new climate-based decision tools that, first of all, tell them, is this part of normal bad weather or is this climate change? Then they need to have to, they need tools at least. I don't think we can tell them what to do in terms of, we don't have that kind of information, but they have to look at their own farm and have the right tools to look at the economic impacts of doing nothing and letting climate change hit them as it may, or investing in a new drainage system, new irrigation system, or both, and then when do they do that? So to just kind of summarize, and we don't have time to go through this in a lot of detail, but there's a list of things that are what can be done on the farm and by the farmer, and for those of us working closely with farmers, we can work with them on it. Simple, some things fairly inexpensive, shifting planting dates, new varieties, working with breeders and seed companies to identify new varieties that are adapted to new climates. Certainly, we'd like to get ahead of this thing of new pest diseases and weeds. I mean, we don't want to just see increased chemical loads to regions where they're getting a lot of a new cadre of pests. So what can we do proactively to avoid that? With the water issues, both irrigation and drainage, depends on where you are, of course, how important some of these are going to be, but very important. For livestock facilities, there's things like investments in new venting, et cetera. Certainly, if you're building a dairy barn today, you should not be building it based on the heat specs of yesteryear, but rather build it in terms of what's expected for this century. Then the other ones really get more into what those of us doing research at universities, et cetera, might get involved with. And I've already emphasized quite a bit obviously one of the themes of my talk today is new decision tools for farmers so they can explore the costs, the risks, the benefits, strategic timing of adaptation. There's a lot we can do in terms of crop breeders and livestock breeders developing new crop and livestock options, improving the delivery to farmers of real-time local weather data to provide information on looming intense extreme events. Like I said earlier, we need more than ever IPM type work and actually more coordination across regions with that. A lot of issues with crop insurance and disaster risk management, financial assistance for adaptation measurements, and then climate change policies that integrate economic, environmental, and equity issues. On the equity issues, I want to say a couple of things about that. Of course, we're, I think, all aware of the story about climate change and how its impacts could be much harder on parts of the developing world, both because they're warmer to begin with and don't have the infrastructure and extension systems to help them adapt. And so that's a big issue. But I think even in a place like the U.S., we have small family farms, don't have a lot of capital. They may not go to all the meetings that some of their other farmer neighbors do. And so they may not make the right decision at the right time. So that's a big concern for us. I really would like to make this point that I think, you know, sustainable development, and I suppose many of you in this room, I have projects in developing countries as well as what's going on here, and I think sustainable development, economic development, and climate change are really intricately linked. There's funds from USAID, et cetera, that go into these projects, and from NGOs, CARE International, et cetera. And really, if we don't take care of the climate change issue and get farmers in those regions prepared for climate change, and of course the climate change, we don't do anything as a society to slow it down, those dollars, instead of going into development projects, are going to go to things like disaster mitigation, humanitarian assistance, and conflict resolution, et cetera. There's another link between this, which is between sustainable development and climate change, and that gets into the agricultural mitigation aspect. And so as we think of using conservation agriculture in developing countries and in this country, a lot of these practices, as we've already heard from some of the previous speakers, are relevant to mitigation. So reducing deforestation, agroforestry programs can store carbon as well as have benefits, other benefits. Rotating with legumes reduces nitrogen inputs in terms of fertilizers, minimizing tillage and the soil carbon thing. So all of those things we might do for sustainable development also have a climate change mitigation aspect to them. This is just one example. So this is a project I'm involved with in Zambia. There's a paper in PNAS just came out kind of summarizing this whole program. It's a really neat, something that's been going on long before I got involved. It's called Kamako. It's a co-op of about 30,000, very small, poorest of the poor landholder farmers there in eastern Zambia. They've gotten together as a collective. They market peanut butter and sell it across the nation. Itswild.org is the website for this organization, if you're curious. But they use conservation agriculture. They have kind of their own little extension system using a lot of conservation agriculture things. But they, the guy who sort of has helped coordinate all this, guy named Dale Lewis, got wind of the carbon markets thing and thought, well, we could be added revenue for these farmers if we can get into the carbon markets, since they're doing the conservation agriculture. So we were out there helping them begin looking at soil carbon stocks. They have plans for putting in 750,000 Faderbia albida trees, mimosa-like tree that's nitrogen-fixing, interplanting this in their farms. This would be obviously to supply nitrogen, organic matter to their farms. But, of course, this also could be a carbon market thing. So we went there and looked at some of these trees and looked at their effect on soil carbon and in the soils and all of that. So renewable energy on the farm, this whole mitigation thing, I think I can slide through some of these pretty quickly because some have already been touched on and will be touched on again. Biofuels, this is part of the solution on the mitigation end. I've been kind of focusing most of my talks so far on adaptation, farmers coping with the inevitable, but a lot of farmers can do to be part of the solution. Biofuels, as long as we're not using more fossil fuels to produce the biofuels, it's a good thing. Anaerobic digesters, this is something that farmers are all, you know, they're all about this if they can get their hands on it. Right now these are very expensive, but getting energy from methane, turning a waste into a positive is a good thing. I used this slide at a briefing in D.C., and it took the audience a long time to figure out what it was. But in my cropping systems ecology class I teach to undergrads, I talk about the past generations, you know, did a lot of work in to build the economic viability of our farms, but in that process we really decoupled animal and crop production systems. So your challenge is figuring out how to recouple them, but keep farmers profitable.
What was that picture?
Little cow pie. So in terms of farmer mitigation, unlike some other industries where CO2 and fossil fuel emissions is what it's all about, this nitrous oxide thing is a big part of the issue for farmers. So we've got the farm energy efficiency and these other things, but this improving nitrogen fertilizer and management is a very big part of the story, I think, and something I want to emphasize in my last couple of slides. I have like about 5 minutes left, I think. We already heard from the previous speaker talking about soil organic matter and carbon management. And what's really cool about agriculture as a business and mitigation is, unlike others, some other businesses, a lot of these are really win-win. And I think that's really the way to approach farmers about it, increasing farmer profits and other win-win operations. The nitrogen story, so in addition to the nitrous oxide emissions, of course, there can be as much as 4 to 6 tons of carbon emitted per ton of nitrogen manufactured. So just buying synthetic nitrogen fertilizers is part of the carbon footprint of farming operations, and actually, of course, of many homes that have big lawns and put on a lot of nitrogen fertilizer. But all fertilizers, we have to deal with this nitrous oxide issue. Improving nitrogen management efficiency, rotating with legumes is one solution, of course. My colleague Harold Van Ness has done a lot of work on this program at Cornell called AdaptIn. There's the website for it down here. This is really using real-time weather data and also a soil carbon nitrogen simulation model to help farmers get the most out of sort of the free nitrogen produced by the microbial community, avoid putting on nitrogen just before heavy rains, et cetera, like that, and manage nitrogen much better. Soil health has all these co-benefits that have already been mentioned. Besides the soil carbon sequestration, climate change resilience, et cetera. This thing about measuring soil carbon, how do we start getting track of soil carbon stocks? So I'm part of a new NEPA project that's really focusing on this, developing new greenhouse gas and carbon accounting tools for farmers. And so as was mentioned in the answer to Daniel's question, it's a matter of linking geospatial analysis. This map in the background is actually soil carbon based on existing soil surgo data from the National Soil Survey. But it's quite far from ground, to ground truth that you need some strategic soil sampling and also biogeochemical models, et cetera. This is Comet Farm, which is a web tool we're working with on this project. This Keith Poston and Steve Ogle and some others have really led the way in that, and they're part of this project. There's a web interface for farmers way down here. We've got Descent simulation model, but it's a way to provide farmers with new information about greenhouse gases and carbon. There's a lot of new things we can do in terms of looking at how do we measure carbon effectively, such as the proximal remote sensing, the VNIR methodology, which we're looking at as part of this project as well. I wanted to not leave out the communication challenge. Those of you who work with farmers and climate change know that, this is a challenging area to talk to farmers about. I've talked to them for years about soil health and all of that, but when I talk to them about climate, it's highly politicized, and I do worry about our farming community not getting on top of this issue soon enough. Because culturally or for other reasons, they have resistance to it. So I think we really have to address that. And I'm not a communication specialist, but we have some of those at Cornell. And I think for future meetings, having some communication specialists talking to us about how to communicate this effectively and motivate change where it's needed is important. I think one approach to farmers is, talking about it's not just an uncertain climate future, but also uncertain energy future. And in any case, if you're a good business person, being prepared makes good business sense. And if you're prepared, you might be able to take advantage of new market opportunities that might develop with climate change. And then you need to make these strategic decisions regarding capital investments. And if you are a farmer and you're ignoring the climate change story that's going on in your area, you might make the wrong decisions on investments in irrigation or drainage systems, et cetera. We need to anticipate these new weed, disease, insect pests. So rather than waiting till you get struck all of a sudden, I think by, you know, understanding climate change and what it means for these things is important for farmers. And then we need not only the farmers, but society in general needs to make sure we're avoiding unintended consequences of climate change and farmer adaptation to climate change, such as increased chemical loads to waterways, undesirable land use change and degradation. And then we need to be promoting research and policies that support farmer needs for adaptation and mitigation, and then taking advantage of energy policy incentive programs for emerging carbon markets if they develop. Finally, I just wanted to show a few. There was a science roadmap put together by the land-grant universities. Jim Jones was part of that, as well as several others, and came up with a list of research needs. And since I'm out of time, I think I'll just put these up very quickly. But in terms of what we really need in terms of research, an effort was made by a group of us to put some of these things together. In terms of climate science, we need more regional downscaling. And then we need, of course, investment in looking at future weed insect pests, better economic assessments to help with these decision tools, decision science itself. There's a whole science to that. Food and resource systems, breeding for crop and livestock tolerance, improved water management, non-chemical options for pests, and then these greenhouse gas, soil carbon tools, and then last but not least, communication. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
We do have time for some questions for Dave. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so the question is, I mean, there's both for farmers, there's costs of trying to do these things, as I did mention, but also for us researchers, there's budget cuts, and it's, you know, is the public really willing to support the research we need? And, well, that's something I guess we all worry about and wonder about. I mean, I'm enthused, actually, to see at this society how many young to old scientists are working on this compared to, actually, last time I was at the meetings, like about 5 years ago. You know, there was, I think, maybe just one or two sessions on this. So, and I assume some of those people are getting funded, so the money is coming. But we have to, I think, as a society, of course, do our own communication effectively on that.
Great. I was wondering, in terms of the sustainability,
Yeah. Well, if I understand the question, it has to get, it gets to the point of inequities, the inequity problems between developed and developing countries, and the overall global goal of more, you know, sustainability, and how we deal with that. Of course, obviously, there's I guess policy solutions to some of those things, but I think that part of it is. Bring, you know, just a lot of effort to bring those economies of developing countries up to speed. And I think, you know, hopefully some leapfrogging that can happen so that, you know, we can move quickly in developing countries to projects and to approaches that lead them sort of quickly to climate change preparedness as well as better economic development for those regions. But it's just, I guess you're just commenting in some ways about that is a big challenge.
Thank you. Thanks,
yeah.
Dave.
Well, thanks.